Welcome to an all-new episode of Get Lit with Leanna, the podcast. Join me as I sit down with a new guest author in each episode to discuss their books, careers, and everything in between. Today, I'm joined with romance author Lindsay Kelk to talk about her new book, Love Me Do. Lindsay has written so many books, so I was very excited to get to chat with her today about the beginning of her career, but also about so many of her other projects. I had no idea that she was like such a podcaster with such a versatile background. We also got to talking about a new project she has coming out, an adaptation of one of her books. You'll have to listen to learn more. Of course, we spoke about her latest release, the inspiration behind the story and characters, and what she hopes readers take away. So without further ado, my conversation with the very sweet and very funny Lindsay Kelk starts right now. Welcome, Lindsay, to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here. I've obviously been following your career, familiar with your books for quite some time. So I'm like super excited to have you on the show. And obviously you're here today to talk about your latest release, Love Me Do, which is very exciting. But before we talk about that book, I would love to just get to know a little bit more about you and your background, because I feel like though I'm familiar with your books, like I don't know so much about you and your background. And I know you have like so many different endeavors aside from writing as well. Super curious to kind of dig in and sort of understand like how all this kind of started, when you started writing, like how, take me back to like early days.
Yeah. I mean, early days are early days. So absolutely. I was one of those annoying kids that just loved writing and was writing from a really early age. I mean, I was one of those annoying kids in that literally I would do anything. I was always doing stuff. Like, and I always wanted to get involved in everything, unless it was physical activity, less interested in that. Although I did start a soccer team at my school because I said it was sexist that we didn't have one, because I was that kid, you know, it's like the annoying kid. And then was like, wait, I have to play now? What? But yeah, I always loved reading. I always loved writing from being really, really young. And then studied creative writing at university, did my dissertation in creative writing, and then kind of left uni thinking I never wanted to pick up a book again, because it was three very intense years of English degree. I worked in PR for a couple of years and then moved into publishing, and I was an editorial assistant in children's publishing.
Wow.
In the UK, and I worked in film and TV tie-in. So I worked on some DreamWorks books. I did some Shrek the Third shenanigans.
Fun.
Yes. Yeah. I got to write some Mary-Kate and Ashley stuff. That was very cool.
Wow. Big fan of Mary-Kate and Ashley.
Right? Yeah. It's very exciting. I got to meet them. It was very exciting. Do you know what? They were super intense. So it was before they had taken over the company. They were still Mary-Kate and Ashley. So right before then, and Mary-Kate was super, super psyched and overexcited because they had just met Ross from Friends, her words, not mine, the bar of the hotel. She's like, we just met Ross from Friends. I'm like, cool. But Ashley was all business. Ashley was like, on which part of the business do you work in? And what's the annual revenue? And what's your turnover? And I was like, wow, she's 20 and she's terrifying.
Right.
So interesting, but awesome. So I was doing that. And that was how I got into publishing, because I knew I wanted to work with books, but I grew up in a really working class mining village in the north of England. You know, you don't get to be a writer. You don't get to work in publishing. If you like books, you have to be a teacher. Like, you know, it's like, that's what I was told was the only path available to me. So it took me a really long time to sort of even get book adjacent. And then once I was working in at HarperCollins in the children's team, once I saw how publishing works, and I realized the whole thing is an absolute crapshoot and no one knows what's going to work or how it's going to go, I was like, well, maybe I should try writing something and see what happens. Yeah. And that's how it went. So I wrote my first book. I wrote I Heart New York and managed to get it published. And it's still a miracle to me. Like, having seen both sides of it, it remains a miracle to me when any book makes it onto a bookshelf.
Wild.
It's crazy.
Any point though in this, like, I'm going to write a book, I'm writing a book, I'm getting a book published, like, was there any part of you that was like, maybe I want to try to self-publish? Like, what was the landscape of publishing?
Yeah.
published
your first book? Very different because this was, I'm old, she says, but it was, I started writing in 2006. I started writing I Heart New York in 2006. So self-publishing was not really as big of a thing, definitely not a respected thing. And fanfic wasn't where it is now at all. Like, I wouldn't have even known where to start with that. So I had written I Heart New York and sent it out to agents, all the traditional things, sent it out to every agent in London with the cover note, with the, like, this is why. It was rejected by every single agent in the UK, like every one of them. And at that point, I'd actually just started blogging as well at the same time. I started beauty blogging. So I was like, maybe I'll release like a chapter a week on my blog, which now is self-publishing. And I just didn't have the terminology for it then. As it happened, the movement happened before I got to that point. Because I then did hear back from one agent. She was interested in working with me, but not on this book. She was like, I hate the book. There is no story, but like, you can write, there is no story. And I was like, oh, this is really weird, because you're a really well-respected, legit agent, but I feel like there is a story and I love it. So I made the bold move to decline to work with this person.
Wow.
And asked a friend at Harper to ask someone at HarperCollins if they knew any other agents they could introduce me to who would just give me feedback, because I wasn't even getting feedback. I just was getting very polite postcards. And one agent who wrote me and said, have you thought about writing a psychological thriller? I'm like, no, it's rom-com.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, what about I Heart New York said psychological thriller?
Yeah.
Yeah, so then this, it was very lucky. We joke about it now, but this friend who I'd worked with in children's, who knew a lot of agents, basically didn't know what to do, had said she would help me, but then kind of didn't know how. So she handed it off to another friend who was like, can you help her? And that person ended up being the publisher of women's fiction at HarperCollins. So she read it and then she said, hey, I love it. I want to publish it. So it was a very roundabout way. It wasn't a normal route to publishing, because I did my own deal without an agent. But I also had worked in publishing, so I knew my way around contracts. I always say, don't do what I did. Like, please don't sign up to one of those big publisher contracts unless you know your way around that specific contract. But yeah, so that's how I got to be published. That's how it went from, what have I done here? And there was 18 months between being finished and getting the deal done. I was too busy getting rejected by every agent in the UK.
A wild trajectory. And then, like, at what point do you remember kind of recognizing success beyond the UK? Like, at what point did you realize, like, okay, now I'm noticing I have like a fan base or a dedicated reader base in like other parts of the world? Like, what was that experience?
Yeah, I don't even know. I think maybe I'm still waiting to know that. I guess it was, I went up to Canada. I went to do an event in Canada.
Okay, where in Canada? That's where I'm based.
So in Toronto. Yeah, I was in Toronto. Yeah, I love Toronto. And I think I'd been, the first time I went up, I went to a sales conference to present the book when it started in Montreal. And I was like, oh, this is lovely. How nice.
But that's, I didn't really, I take born. It. You're hitting up
no
all
way.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was gorgeous. But I was like, this isn't real because it's a sales conference. And then I became really good friends with my Canadian publicist. So I would go hang out with her a bunch. And I was in New York at the time. So New York to Toronto, you know, it was easy. So I would go hang out with her all the time. I was in Toronto all the time. Ask me anything about the pickle barrel menu. Like,
the matzo ball soup.
It's all over pickle barrel, over pickle barrel.
It's so good. It's so
right. Because we would go out the night before and then we would get up, go to pickle barrel, go to the movies. And like, that would be our hangover day.
That's
perfect day. Yeah. So it hadn't occurred to me that I was out there, because I would go and hang out with my friend. And then one time we did an event, I think with Elle Canada. And I went thinking it would be like a few people. We went and it was this massive, massive event space. And then they were like, yeah, go talk about your book. I was like, oh, I don't know. It just really threw me. I just wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
But it was really fun.
Yeah.
But that was a learning experience for sure.
So aside from writing, we'll get back to writing in a minute, but aside from writing, I know, and I could see from the video, you have an intense microphone. Clearly, this is not your
microphone
or doing a podcast. And I know you have two different podcasts and they're both like wildly different. So tell me about your podcast and like how all of that came to you. Cause I feel like that's so cool. And I rarely get to talk to authors who are like familiar with this space as well.
Oh yeah. I love a podcast. I love listening to podcasts. I love being on podcasts. I love a chat. I don't know if that's come across. I love a chat about anything. So I have two podcasts that I'm a part of. The first is Full Coverage, which is my beauty podcast. I just really love the beauty space. My first two jobs were in PR out of university. And one of them was an agency and we did some beauty stuff. And I'd always loved beauty as a kid. Like my aunt was a total glamour puss, like a full 80s, like,
love
perfect hair, nails, even to go to aerobics, like the two-tone pink and purple eyeshadow. And I was obsessed with her. But I didn't know how to get into it really. And I didn't ever knew what I was doing. And then when I worked in PR for a little while, I picked up some stuff and I just loved the space. And I love how it's grown. I love how accessible it is now. It terrifies me when I see 14-year-olds in like absolutely perfect makeup. I'm like, no, where is the orange mark around your face and the mascara under your eyes? You should have. Yeah. It's a rite of passage. But I love it. And when I started the podcast, I was working with my friend Harriet Hadfield, who's a makeup artist. So I was writing about beauty and she was a makeup artist making YouTube. So we were like making YouTube videos. So we said, what can we do together that's different to that? And there were only a couple of beauty podcasts then. We were like, well, I guess we'll see if people really want to listen to us yap on about lipstick. And they did. So that's how it started. It's very low key. I am a beauty enthusiast. She's a professional. I have no idea what I'm doing. I just love it. And I love the idea that beauty is for everybody now. And it's not exclusionary. It's not, you have to be perfect. You have to look like this. You have to do that. I think it's just anyone who likes it should be able to be part of it.
100%. And then
so that's Full Coverage.
The other podcast.
The other podcast is about professional wrestling, tights and fights. Yeah. Just for a quick 180. Although, you know what? There is a crossover. Like there is a Venn diagram of beauty girls, rom-com girls and wrestling girls.
Seriously.
And I respect it. Yeah. I mean, you're Canadian. So wrestling is a big part of Canadian culture. Like a lot of very classic wrestlers from Canada.
I mean, so I've heard, but I'm so not. Talk to me about hockey. Okay, fine.
Excellent.
I'm like super, I'm not really exposed, I feel.
It's fair. And my exposure came via my older brother. So he was into it when we were kids. And I was like, I guess I'm into it because I'm into anything he's into, as a little sister always is. And then I stopped watching it, didn't really think about it. And it was actually through the children's books at Harper when I was doing the film and TV tie-ins, WWE approached us about doing books and no one in the company knew anything about wrestling. And I was like, well, I'll take the meeting because I used to watch it as a kid. And they had us go to an event and do the meeting there. And I was just like, wait, this is still awesome. And fell all, like, back into it.
Yeah,
and I know,
which is insane.
Weirdly connected. So they dragged me back in when I was about 25, 26. And then when I moved to the States, I was like, I could just go to this sometimes.
Yeah.
It just went from there. And when I moved to LA, when I left New York and moved to LA, again, a friend of a friend was like, oh, I know someone who has a wrestling podcast. Would you want to go be a guest? And that was Tights and Fights. And then they were also, it turned out, looking for a new co-host. So guess who loves a chat and also wrestling? Yeah. Guess who was available for an hour a week? It was me.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like so much of your like path leading you to where you are now has been so intertwined in such like weird, different, like serendipitous type ways.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Like your history working in film and TV obviously now kind of connects to projects you're working on now. I don't know how much we could talk about it, but obviously there's a project in the works that's being adapted, one of your books, into a film or movie. I'm not sure what, or a TV show.
It's a TV series right now. Yeah.
So what are we allowed to talk about? What can you kind of share about this process? I'm someone that's obsessed with adaptations. Like that's my favorite.
Yes, ever. Same.
My dream job is to be like on like a set of some sort and like as like on like a consultation basis, making sure that the books are being like properly adapted, that would make the fan happy. Like, even if it's not a perfect adaptation, in a way that like, I know would appease the audience that is like, yes, waiting for this.
That's and that's such a big job. Yeah.
It's my dream job. So I love getting to talk to authors that have projects in the works like this, or have like successfully done it. Cause it's like such a niche thing that I feel is getting even bigger and bigger and more popular. And I love
for sure.
So like, tell me whatever you're allowed to share about what's going
on. Yeah. So there's a couple of things in development. The one that I'm working on now that is a little bit further along, it isn't announced, so I can't go into detail. Although mostly that seems to be because people are afraid of cursing it. They're like, don't talk about it in case it goes away. I'm like, it better not. but I guess it could, because that's Hollywood. Although this is actually set up in the UK, which is obviously, I have to say, the WGA strike is happening now. So nothing can be happening in the States, which really sucks for all of my fellow friends out here in America. But this is all in the UK, so slightly different situation. And we haven't started writing it. We're still in developing. But it is nuts how it goes. Like, you know, someone will just contact you and be like, we like this book, want to make an adaptation? And you're like, yeah, I do. Okay. And then like a year later, something might, you know, it's like, it's such a slow process until it isn't. And then it's everything at once. Mm. And like you say, it's such an interesting process, because it's such a learning experience for me to be on this side of it. And I have actually written novelizations of movies. I used to do that as a ghostwriter when I was starting out. Yeah, really fun. And then to go the other way around, to take the novel that you wrote and then adapt that into a screenplay. Because, adapting a screenplay into a novel is such a weird task.
I'll imagine. That's like...
Because you don't...
It's like the flip. Normally you have like adapting a novel into a screenplay, but to adapt a screenplay into a book. I remember growing up, like there was a movie theater that we would all go to. Like it was in a little mall near our house, and in the mall right across from the theater was like an Indigo, which is like the Canadian bookstore. Yeah.
Love an Indigo.
Love an Indigo. And it was always like the treat at the end of the movie. Like we would go to the bookstore and you could buy a book. And I remember often seeing like the book of the movie there.
Of the movie.
And wanting to be like, and wanting to buy it. And my parents being like, no, you just saw the movie. And because they wrote it about the movie. So get a new story that you could read. Like I just remember always being like told that I can't get the book adaptation of the movie. So it's so interesting for now for you to be on the flip side. Do you know like how involved you can be in the process? Like, are you actually going to be the one adapting it?
Yeah, on this one, I am attached to adapt. So I am, it's all on me, basically. I'm like, this is all my fault.
No, it's great.
But it is interesting. Yeah, like you say, because this is a book I wrote a while ago. So there's a time factor in updating it. But it is also, you're very much taking the spirit of the book and making it work. And it is different. It's the same story, but it's completely different. It's such a wild ride, and the characters are the same characters, but they're doing different things.
Yeah,
because you got to build it out, and you have to put in side plots, and you have to put in other character things. You know, you're not following one character on her journey now. You're following like a bunch of characters, and all of their lives have to mean something, and everyone's story has to live and grow and breathe. Especially if you want to be an ongoing series, it's like, okay, wow.
The longevity of it, you need to consider. Yeah. It's also such like a different writing muscle, I imagine, like writing for the screen versus writing for like a novel. And I mean, obviously you're well-versed in it because of your background, but like, it's still such an, I'm sure like an exciting thing that you get to tackle and something so different, considering you have so many books out, like why not try a different type of writing, which is so cool and so exciting.
Yeah. It's like, I always, I'm going to take credit for it, but I stole it from someone else. It's just been so long ago. I can't remember who, but it's like exercising a different muscle. So it's like, if you love yoga, maybe try Pilates, you know, it's like, it's similar, but it's different. You might enjoy mixing it up. And I have really enjoyed it, but yeah, it is so different because writing a novel is, you're building it out and you're making the world real and it's all interior. You know, you're trying to get into the heads of these characters and why they're doing the things that they do. And then you get a screenplay and all you can do is put words in people's mouths.
Right.
And it's like, wait, what? Like, she can't just sit for 4 pages in a bubble bath thinking about the things that she's done. It's like, no, that is a 10-second scene where you just see her sighing in a bubble bath. It's like, oh, that's shit. True.
No, that's put it in like that kind of perspective. It's crazy how much we get out of books from like interior thoughts that you don't get on film. But obviously the reason why we're here is to talk about Love Me Do. So I don't want to like push this conversation any further without addressing it. So for those who have not yet read the book, because by the time this podcast episode comes out, the book will have like just been out. So tell me a little bit about what people can expect from the story.
I should be so much better at this part of the job than I am. It's the worst part of it. Like, I don't know. It's a book. So it's a rom-com. Which is, you know, a given, I think, at this point. But it's a rom-com. It is the easiest way to describe it, because this is what it is, and I keep forgetting to mention that, is it is a updated retelling of Cyrano. So it is a Cyrano storyline, an agenda-flipped Cyrano. So I actually did an event with Elena Armas in London, and she did the most incredible job of like concisely describing the book and just listed all these tropes. And I was like, wow, I didn't even know. But she's like, it is a matchmaker trope. It is a friends and lovers trope. It is all these. I was like, I love this, Elena. Please come with me everywhere I go, because I don't know what I'm doing. But yeah, definitely Cyrano rom-com is the best place to start. It is fun. It is funny. You've got female friendship in there, which I think is really important, and sisterhood in there, intergenerational friendships, and a really hot dude who likes bird watching and wears gray sweatpants, but is also a delight, I think is important to say.
Yeah. So I feel like a lot of your books are obviously, they're so well loved. A lot of them are so well loved, but where do you get like the inspiration for each of your stories? Like, especially for this book, like where did this concept come to you from? Like, how did this idea pop into your brain, and how did you kind of outline it, or did you outline it?
I don't outline. I'm a terrible monster who just sits down at a laptop and hopes for the best, with varying results. I gotta say. So this one was an interesting one. It's kind of, it was a convergence of sort of three ideas. So the first one, I knew I wanted to write about LA. I've been living in LA for 8.5 years, which is insane. And I'd written about LA once before, but before I lived here, and when I really hated it, I was like, this place sucks. So you have to drive everywhere and everyone's awful. And then when I moved here, because I met my now husband, was living out here, I was like, well, I guess I'll go live there for a little while and see what happens. And I found this whole new side of LA, and I discovered what it's like to live here, and like the not Beverly Hills Housewives part, you know, like living on the east side where it's beautiful and there's parks and hiking and it's just gorgeous, and there's actual history, and it's a really lovely, beautiful place to be. So I knew I wanted to tell that story. I knew I wanted to do a Cyrano story, which is something that had been playing on my mind for a little while. I will now reach my down with the patriarchy point of every interview I've ever done in my entire life. But when you think about Cyrano, like the original Cyrano de Bergerac story, it's like this dude who is super smart and eloquent and articulate, but he thinks he can't date his hot cousin, leaving the cousin part out because that's weird. But he thinks he's not worthy because he has a big nose. Like he's like, oh, she'll never love me because I have a huge nose. And it just made me think about all the reasons women think they're not worthy. And it doesn't take a supposed physical deformity. You know, it's like we are constantly told or believe that we're not good enough for something. And we internalize that forever and ever and ever. And I just kept getting really annoyed by Cyrano that I'm like, no, he thinks he's awesome. He just won't ask her out because he has a big nose. Yeah. And the other guy won't ask her out because he can't work out what to say to her. But neither of them think, you know, they're not sat there going like, no, I'm a bad person, or I'm not smart enough, or like, I don't deserve that, you know? So it's like, women don't need anything wrong with them to believe that they don't deserve things. They've just been told it and internalized it and accepted it. So I wanted to tell that story. I wanted to see what that looked like on modern women, and remind us all that it's, for want of a better phrase, bullshit. Like, you absolutely deserve all the things that you want in life, and you should go after them. So that was it. And then the third thing, which again, it's like, I can't believe it took me this long to mention it, was I was really inspired by the Taylor Swift song Speak Now, because the very early drafts of this book started with the Phoebe character protesting at a wedding, because she was like, no, this guy sucks. Don't marry this guy. And then she had to vamoose because she had done that. And that's how she got to LA in the original version of the story. which, as anyone who reads it or has read it will know, evolved into something slightly different. But that was the origin of it.
Okay.
Because I love that song, and I
love it.
I'm like, what would they do afterwards? And like, what do you do if, when you stand up and say don't marry that person, they do marry that person? Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was sort of the weird convergence, and then it just very much turned into its own thing.
Wild.
Once it started.
Right. And obviously this book is super character driven. I mean, like, everyone that's read this book that I know of, that I'm like chatting with on my Instagram, they are all just like raving about the character development and obviously all those side stories and kind of what you mentioned before about like women friendships and that intergenerational friendships and all of those storylines. Why was that something you really wanted to include in this story? Like, why was that an important piece?
That really goes back all the way to that first agent that I worked with who hated my book and said that my name sounded like a cat being sick. I can't work out why we didn't get along. Yeah, she said I had to change my last name because it sounded like a cat vomiting. And okay. I have cats and I hear them vomit, and it like doesn't. I don't think they're shouting. Yeah. You know, I'm like, no, it just sounds like a human being sick. Anyway, I have always remembered her biggest problem with I Heart New York was that there wasn't a female villain. And she says, you always have to, in this kind of a book, for women to embrace it, there has to be a female villain for them to rally behind, to like, for everyone to get behind hating this person. And it always bothered me because it's like, why do we always have to have a woman to hate?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know it was a different time. The 2000s were a toxic place, and we all know that now. But it's always just something that's really bothered me. And I think if I have ever written a female villain into a book, she always had a reason for being the way that she was. You know, we always dug into that and found out why. But in this one, I really didn't want to have a villain. I really just wanted to look at why people do the things that they do. Mm. And there doesn't have to be a villain. It can just be that people have things that they want out of life and it doesn't always align.
100%.
You can have a male villain. That's fine. We got one of those. But even, you know, we don't dig into who he is and what he does and why he did it. But, you know, like he has an MO and he does the whole thing. But yeah, it was really important to me to show that we don't always have to have a villain. I didn't want to write a standard love triangle trope because I hate that idea of pitting women against each other. It's not necessary. And then I really wanted to have the intergenerational friendship, partly because I am at heart an 82-year-old woman. And I want nothing more than to live in a Hollywood mansion and be a recluse. Yeah, we've been watching a lot of Criterion Collection movies. We've been watching a lot of pre-code Paramount, like 30s movies. And I have become obsessed with every actress that ever lived in that time period.
I love
which
that.
Is where Myrna came from, and I'm obsessed with Myrna Moore. She is my favorite character I've ever written,
and I feel like everybody, like the consensus across the board is everyone's like, we need more Myrna. Like, that's like the
I know same
vibe. Yeah,
you're preaching to the converted. Every other conversation with my editor, I'm like, what if we had time to write a cozy crime series, which was the Myrna Moore mysteries, and like Myrna and Phoebe just solve old Hollywood crimes?
Why don't you do that as like a, no, not even 100% as a book, but like as like a mini like online web series for someone. Like, that would be
fun.
Yes.
It would be so fun, and it would make me so happy. And if I wasn't writing two books and working on three screenplays,
I know you're like literally the busiest human of all time.
It makes me so mad because there just isn't enough time for me to do everything I want to do, and it also because I do love a sit down. So adding it all in together is a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
Hear you. Kind of to go back to what we were talking about before, or rather what you were talking about before, about how Elena Armas was like dropping all of these trope titles to you. Yeah. Obviously, it's like hard to kind of think back on like the process. And obviously, you just mentioned too that like you didn't really like structure this book in terms of like an outline. You kind of just went with it. But obviously, it plays on so many different tropes. And everyone that reads romance or like reads rom-com, like they love a good trope. What are your favorite tropes? And like when you were writing this book, were you kind of intentional in any way with the tropes you were including? Or was it kind of just like writing it and whatever trope it is? Like, tell me about.
Yeah, it's so funny because I think because when I started writing, I mean, when I first wrote my I Heart New York, I wasn't writing it for anyone. I just wrote it for me to write because I wanted to start writing again. And that was the book that came out. Like, I was in a very unhappy relationship. I hated my job. I wanted to go to New York. I was living in London. I'm like, oh, if I could write like my fantasy right now, what is it? And that's how that book came about. So that's how that one happened. And then back in the late 2000s, early 2010s, like tropes were really frowned upon. You know, it was to say something was tropey is an insult.
Yeah.
So you weren't supposed to write to tropes. You weren't supposed to have identifiable tropes in your books, even though every book has identifiable tropes.
Exactly.
I know, it's nuts. And I will even say, like, from being in it now, having been in the business for such a long time, even talking to the people I work with, publishing, which is such an interesting conversation to have about self-publishing, like you mentioned, and the books that are doing so well right now and them having come from fanfic and self-pop, publishing was so slow on the uptake. Like, a lot of people I know in traditional publishing were so sneery and snooty about tropes. They'd be like, "Ugh, all they want to do is like list tropes." I'm like, yeah, so get on that. Like, it's like, if that's what readers want, who are you to tell them they can't have it? And that's always been a big problem with me with traditional publishing. Like, there is a lot of, I think there can be a very snooty attitude. And I have been really happy to see movements towards changing the establishment in the last few years, because having seen it firsthand, having really struggled to get a foot on that ladder on the editorial side of things myself, because I wasn't from the right town and I didn't go to the right school, and I had to come in a really weird background way, you know, to get into publishing in the first place. They never would have hired me if I hadn't joined the film and TV tie-in and come from that background in the first place. I really hate when someone tells you what your readers want, because I don't think a lot of people know. Yeah. I don't know how many people in publishing are actually on TikTok or actually talking to readers or reading reviews.
Yeah.
I don't know. So when people are sneery about tropes, it's like when people used to be sneery about selling books in grocery stores in the UK and supermarkets. And then suddenly supermarkets were moving more books than anyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, you were shitty about that. Like, you remember when you were like, ew, grocery stores.
Yeah.
And they're the same with tropes. It's very strange. But with that in mind, like, I don't write to trope because that's just not how I've ever done it. So they come up. I remember writing a book called One in a Million, and there's a just one bed incident in One in a Million, and I fully thought I'd invented that. Like, I thought I invented that in like 2017 or whenever I wrote that.
That is so funny.
It's so stupid. I was like, oh my god, and then the sofa breaks and they have to share a bed, and then I'm like, oh, you fool. you idiot.
There's a whole book of book people who are just looking for a book with one
thing
like that.
Yeah. I know. I'm like, guys, can we rejacket this so it just says on the front, just one bed? Like, that's all it says. Because I was like, that's a modernized My Fair Lady. And they were like, nope, just one bed. I'm like, cool, noted, just one bed. So yeah, I really didn't think about it. And then when they asked me, when they're doing the marketing, I'm like, I don't know. I need Elena with me at all times, basically, to just sit there and say, friends to lovers, love triangle, matchmaker, love letters. I'm like, keep going.
It's so good.
Grey Sweatpants, which is its own trope now, which is so exciting.
Wait, what?
Grey Sweatpants.
It's its own trope?
Apparently so. There's a whole bunch of people who just love a fella in grey sweatpants.
Okay, so I don't know if you know this. I do trope roundups like all the time, and I'm constantly...
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I'm constantly...
Grey Sweatpants. I'll let you work out why in your own time.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I have some research to do now.
Yeah, you do. I blame John Hamm, but knows?
That's too good. So now that the book is like out, by the time people are reading this, what are you hoping that like they really take away from this book in particular, like this story? What are you hoping they really like leave feeling or thinking about, or what they will recommend to a friend about this book? Like, what's the goal?
My primary goal is always just to have people enjoy themselves for a period of time. I know that sounds insane, but they're my favorite messages to get. And there's like, oh, I read it on my way to work and I hate that commute, but it made me laugh. Or like, I read it on vacation and it really like made my afternoon great. You know, like, that's all I want, is for people to enjoy it. If it goes past that, I guess I just want people to... There's a line in the book which someone just posted, which was really helpful because I can't remember what I wrote a year ago. But the Myrna character has a whole conversation with someone where she says, why not you? Basically, she's like, you know, her motto in life is, why not me? And I am really bad at that. I am really bad at asking for what I want and asking for what I deserve and believing that I'm worth it, because it's not how I was raised. It's not how I grew up in this tiny working class mining village, you know, like, you got what you were given and you were grateful. Right. And anything above and beyond that, you were lucky to have it. So it's been a real adjustment, especially working, like you say, in adaptations and then even in publishing, which is a very upper middle class industry. And I was sat there going like, I don't know, what should I do? It's been a hard lesson to learn that you have to ask for what you want, and you should, and you are worth it. You deserve it in romance, in friendship, in work, like anywhere you want something, you should ask for it. And if it's not on the table for you, then go from there. But don't just accept what you think you deserve.
Love that. I love that.
So that's my message. That's what Phoebe has to learn in this book.
Okay. Well, what a fabulous way to end this conversation. That was like such a high note. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you have like a really wacky schedule, and it was like getting there whether or not we were going to make this work. So I
knew we were going to make it work.
Yeah.
It's like it's going to happen.
Thank you for the time, and I'm such a fan, and I'm wishing you all the success and all of the luck with all of these projects that you have coming up.
No, thank you so much. And hopefully I'll be in Toronto soon and come
please
give you a high five.
Yes. Yeah. I would love to meet you at a pickle barrel for some matzo ball soup.
Yes. I want a big giant neon colored cocktail.
Oh, 100% visual. Let's do it. I love that.
Yes, please.